Hi, this is Tracy Edwards. I'm the skipper of Maiden, the first all-female crew to sail around the world, and you're listening to Verbal Shenanigans.
But our shenanigans are cheeky and fun.
Yeah, I mean, his shenanigans are cruel and tragic.
Which makes them not shenanigans at all, really.
Evil shenanigans.
I swear to God, I'll pistol whip the next guy that says shenanigans.
All right, hello everybody. What is going on? Welcome on back to the Verbal Shenanigans podcast. I am Scott. That is Mike down there in the Great Peach, or whatever they call it, the Peach State, the Peach.
The Great Peach, yes, yes, that's what they call it. I mean, it was the Peach State, but now that you said it, I'm going to send a few letters to. I'll just go to Market, Georgia, see who it goes to, and then I think we're going to get this pushed through.
The Great Peach has a good ring to it. It makes it seem even more royal. Regal. Yeah. That's the word I'm looking for.
Yeah. Like if you say the Peach State, it's like, all right, you know, you're kind of known for it. I don't know how good they are, but when you're like the Great Peach, it's like, oh, I gotta get down there now. like these Jersey peaches are clearly inferior to what's going on down there. So
if you're just tuning in, this is Verbal Shenanigans. We are a weekly show that likes to basically bring on interesting guests and talk about life and what have you and all that. And that's kind of how the show rolls. So, in fact, we took right before the show, Mike Berlew referenced Silk Stockings. Not like he puts them on, like the show Silk Stockings, a musical, I believe it started out as.
I don't know. For what I remember, it was like when HBO was getting a little frisky with some of their shows. That was like the Showtime.
Oh,
all right, we're coming right back at you show, if I recall.
Maybe that was a redo. Because when you said it, I was like, I got to type in Silk Stockings. Apparently that was a musical in 1957. So you're really...
I went ultra old school. I'm like,
you're going like pre-TV nudity there.
Oh yeah, like your parents are got that big ham radio or whatever in the middle of the living room, and they're just sitting in front of it waiting to hear from Silk Stockings.
your dad's at, it's like 2 o'clock in the morning. It's real quiet. He's by the radio, like, oh yes, Silk Stockings coming on.
What's that noise? Don't come in here, Mom.
Let me see.
You'd leave the radio on again.
Silk Stockings, HBO, maybe? Silk Stockings.
I thought it was Showtime.
Oh, wait. What about there's Silk Stockings? It was an American crime television series on CBS in 1991. Mm. You're getting closer here.
Oh.
Silk Stockings, a TV series.
Maybe I just made up the thing in my head. Maybe all along it's like, but I remember it. No, Mike, you were just in another room talking to yourself again. Well, the octopus and Chili Willy were there, and you were just going away talking about Silk Stockings.
Well, apparently Silk Stockings ran from 91 to 99, so this might be the show you were talking about. That's more in the wheelhouse of than the 1957 musical that unless you were referencing that, which I wouldn't put it past you, but you know, you're not that old.
No, not that old. Getting there, but not at that point.
Silk Star. Okay, so next week, guys, we will have the cast of Silk Stockings.
We're going to have the 90-year-old woman who was known for her sultry voice in the 50s radio play of Silk Stockings.
Maybe that's
I got so much fan letters.
Maybe instead of finding like anyone relevant, we need to be like a podcast that just like breaks down old 90s shows and finds guests from them who are probably like, you know, grandmas and stuff now, like not doing much. They were on Silk Stockings season 5.
why not? I mean, this original format hasn't really brought us anywhere, so, you know.
Right.
Gotta switch things up.
Speaking of, like, guests on this show, kind of that relevant or whatnot. So I was watching the new Dolomite movie, which was phenomenal, by the way. I think with Eddie Murphy as Dolomite.
Okay.
Really good, really good. You should watch it. But I'm watching it, and there's this scene where he's in this club, and he's there's like a musician opening up for him, like an old bluesy musician, blues jazzy kind of musician. I'm like, what, you know, why does that guy look familiar? And I looked closely, and it was Bobby Rush, who we just recently had on the show. They even say his name in it. They're like, "Oh, the great Bobby Rush. Thank you, Bobby." I'm like, "Oh crap, there he is." So it was pretty cool. I was like, "Wow, I remember that guy. That guy was one hell of an interview. I'll never forget Porcupine Meat."
You think if we like send him an email, he can give us Eddie Murphy's information?
Probably. Then again, I've seen like a couple of interviews with Eddie Murphy lately. We might not want to interview him. He's a real dud, which is weird because he's usually, you know, his characters and his comedy, he's so, you know, verbose and loud and entertaining. Like his interviews, I saw him on like a Jimmy Kimmel interview, and even his Comedians on Cars Getting Coffee was kind of just like, he almost sounds like almost like an introvert, which is really strange.
Maybe he just partied so hard that it came out of his system, you know? I mean he's got a comeback pretty much now from where he was. I mean, after that whole thing where, what was it? Was it a transvestite he picked up?
Did he?
Or... Well, I remember he picked up some woman of the night. I can't remember if it was just a regular hooker or a transvestite, but I remember.
Wasn't
he
that Silk Stockings episode 4, Women of the Night?
Yeah, I could be getting confused again, Scotty. I'm sorry, but
you're breaking out all the modern terms here. A woman of the night.
But yeah, he I remember he picked up some girl. I think he was into feet stuff. No, that was like the whole story, but like when it happened, like his career just like fell down after that.
Really?
And then he tried a couple things here or there that didn't really pop up, but now.
But he gets
he's got
paid.
Dolomite movies, got Coming to America 2.
Nice. And apparently he got signed on Netflix to do a stand up again, which is going to be really hard to. Just the amount of attention on that has got to be like hard to not be a letdown, you know, because. You're talking Delirious and Raw, like the two biggest comedy specials maybe ever.
Oh, yeah. I can't fathom it being in that stratosphere. I mean, if he does a great act, people are going to compare it to the 80s and go, nah. If he basically does a one-for-one, just like a raunchy kind of set, then he'll get it from the other side. Yeah. So,
well, maybe it wasn't him that partied all the time. Maybe it was just his girl.
That's true.
My girl wants to party all the time. Party all the time. But you should check out the Dolomite movies. It was awesome. It was like a one. It had like a ridiculous cast, like so many good Keith Robinson and Wesley Snipes is back acting, and it was really good. But it was like a it was funny, but it was also like really interesting. It was like they. It wasn't the Dolomite. It was how he became Dolomite, like the comedian became Dolomite, and how they budgeted everything to eventually make this movie, and kind of how they pulled it off. And it was really well done. Eddie Murphy was fantastic in it. So, I
guess that's where that picture I saw the picture online with him, Wesley Snipes, Will Smith, and Martin Lawrence all together. Maybe that was when they met up and took that picture.
Maybe, but I highly recommend it. It was one of the best movies I've seen in a long time. It had a little bit of everything. It was pretty cool. But yeah, Dolomite. It was like it was really cool because it was like I remember like seeing the Dolomite movie with me and my friends once in like a. We had like a sleepover or something. One of our friends had the tape. It was hilarious. And you know, I didn't know.
Was the sole purpose of the sleepover to go see Dolemite?
No, no. It was, I don't know. It was like one of those things where, like, I think it was late at night and he had, like, a tape of it, or his dad had a tape and we put it on, and it was just, like, ridiculous. And we were, like, 14 and 15, where, like, staying up late and watching movies was, like, as extreme as you get, you know, like, it was, and there was, like, boobies in it and karate, so it was funny, you know?
I'd probably have been like, this is boring. Can I bring my tapes of Silk Stockings that I taped?
the collector's edition and extra scenes.
Mom, if that Burlew kid comes here with like 10 VCR tapes, don't let him in. He's just going to do the same thing over and over.
Yeah, we got, back then it was like, the biggest thing we did was like stay up late and like watch movies and think we were cool. And then like watch a lot of mob movies. And then I remember my friend had his adult movies that he would record off of, cause he had one of those black boxes and he would record like the Spice Channel, but he was so into wrestling. he recorded like all Monday Night Raws and every wrestling event, he would record them all on tape, but he hid his movies from his mother under the title. I'll never forget that it was the best of Hulk Hogan in WCW was the title of his movies. So I would be joking around, be like, hey, you watching Best of Hulk Hogan last night? He's like, nah, not last night. Seen it too many times. You know, it's pretty funny.
The irony is eventually Hulk Hogan did a homemade movie.
Yeah, he did his own.
Yep.
But
then did some other stuff in it that people that frowned upon.
Yeah, well, apparently he's, like, back again. I don't know. I see, like, videos pop up on Facebook, and he seems like he's still just as relevant as ever.
That's the thing, you know, when you're that nostalgic, it's like, all right, you get a 2-year timeout for that N-word thing, but then you can come back. It's all cool.
What's a couple?
You're a real American, buddy. Woo!
What's a couple N-words among friends, you know?
Yeah.
But
I mean, as long as you say your prayers and eat your vitamins, I mean, you'll get the racism out of you, I suppose.
I feel like wrestling is like a thing that is just timeless, and guys have no expiration date until they're dead. Like, they can always find a way to pop up somewhere, whether it's on TV once a year, whether it's at a local gym, at a VFW hall. Like, oh God, it's Earthquake and Typhoon. Like, oh, I'm gonna go, and they'll get a couple suckers to go down and see these guys who are like dilapidated and you know, barely hanging on. But I feel like there's always someone waiting for them.
Yeah, if you ever want to be saddened or have a good laugh, depending on your sense of humor, you have to go to one of the last wrestling events that Scott Hall did when he was right before he went into rehab. Like, they literally had to get two wrestlers to drag him to the ring, and then he literally delivered the slowest chair shot in the history of chair shots. And apparently it was because the promoter was so pissed off since he's screwed him so many times on no shows. He's like, that's it, I'm gonna basically get him embarrassed, and then I'm gonna get the video out there so I can get some money out of this.
Yeah, I thought you were going to say the saddest thing would be to listen to was our podcast from a UPWA wrestling event. I was going to say, yeah, that's pretty sad, too.
Yeah, I mean, that's in the top 10, but I mean, I'll put Scott Hall's wrestling 1. I'll probably put us around number 4 or so.
I think that's why, like, a lot of people are still into wrestling, like, why everybody's still watching. I think it's, like, a thing that has not really changed over 30 years. It's like, yeah, it's gotten more video screens and better technology, but it's still the same crap over and over and over again. And people are like,
pretty much. I mean, what could they really do that it's like, oh, they've never done this before?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. Kill a man?
Owen Hart.
Oh, yeah, well. I don't think they did on purpose. I meant on purpose, like an actual, like, you know, loser dies.
Well, I mean, Owen didn't win the match that night, so.
What about a drug match? Where
a drug match?
Yeah. Like, in each corner, there's a drug that has to be done.
Interesting.
There's like coke on the turnbuckles.
Would there be like the heel manager that has like a syringe that he pops into one guy's rear end so he's like extra high during the match?
Exactly, exactly. Or like he like he put fentanyl in like one of the syringes and he just dies on the mat and that's the end of it.
Ah, I like it. I like it. I like the reboot of The Undertaker.
Has there ever been a character that just openly does drugs? Because I think that would be a pretty funny character. Like Sprinkles. Like this would work in the Attitude Era. Or whatever. Sprinkles cocaine on the rope before he comes in and goes... and just gets ready. Bet you that's never been done. That would be hilarious.
Maybe that's how Hogan hulked up.
Dude, that would be a great character.
Drops his finishing move and like Hogan's, I don't know if he's going to get up. And you just see him do a line on the bottom rope and then he starts shaking it.
Yeah, or
then he does a line on the second rope.
Or like he hits the guy with the chair, you know, the ref's knocked out and he lifts the turnbuckle up and there's just some heroin in there that he starts cooking up.
That'd be a good way to like reintroduce George the Animal Steel. Instead of like eating the turnbuckle, he just snorts it.
Yeah, like for the modern age, for the kids who are so woke and love to party. Maybe there's an open drug addict character. I like it. I don't think it's ever been done.
Yeah, but there, Scott, you're still kind of young in the game and all. They got the training center down in Florida. It's nice weather down there. Why don't you go down there and be like,
oh, my God. No, no. What is he doing? He's heating up a spoon.
You just see you, like, tapping your vein and all getting the fans into the event. Tap. 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 Tap.
Shoot it. Shoot it. Oh, wait a minute. He's rubbing cocaine on his gums.
Kang, I never seen this in all my life.
Wait a minute. He's going through the audience purse. He found scripts. Percocet. And that could be part of his gimmick. Like, he's so high that he doesn't feel any pain. Like, he just pops Percocet during the match, and he's just like, ha-ha! And you just, like, throw him through tables, and then he does, like, an upper, and he gets up, and he hulks out, and he wins.
I like it. Then his manager can turn on him by giving some downers and all. Why is he struggling so much? This is a Survivor Series, damn it!
He's drooling. He's down. You know, picking up his arm. One. Two. Open. I'm going to have to ask our friends at the Shining Wizards. Has there ever been an open drug addict
drug
wrestler? Yeah.
Character.
Right. I'm going to have
Not
to ask.
A wrestler, a character.
And if you're into this wrestling thing, a little promo, our friends at the Shining Wizards Pod, I think they're coming up on like their 8-year celebration or something like that. And they're like all into wrestling. That's what their thing's about. So if you are into wrestling, go check them out. They've been doing it. They've had like basically everybody on that show. For a lot of really interesting guys. But I think it's time to get to our guest. We're about to interview a woman by the name of Tracy Edwards. Basically, what sparked me to try to get in touch with her, I saw a preview for a movie about a boat called The Maiden. And basically, she is one of the she led the first crew of all women to sail around the entire globe in a race back in the day called the Whitbread Race. So, should be pretty fascinating. She recently, like I said, they just put a movie out about her. She's been very busy, so I'm excited that she is going to give us a few minutes here.
I'm guessing she got the world record because there was men on the boat. They wouldn't ask for directions on the proper way to get around the world.
There's still a crew of men somewhere out there. It's like, I know.
Christopher Columbus is still out there. And no, I know India's here somewhere. No, I got this.
Just too stubborn to ask other boats for directions. Too stubborn to use the radio. But so it's pretty cool, especially in like the times we're in, that this is kind of regaining attention as she's going. She went back out on the ship, so I'm excited to give her a call. So I guess without further ado, let's get Tracy Edwards on the line.
Hello.
Hey, Tracy, it's Scott from Verbal Shenanigans. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I am great. And you should hear my buddy and co-host Mike over there. Mike.
Evening, Tracy.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well.
Good.
Tracy, so first off, thanks for we've kind of been playing, I guess, Twitter tag or email tag, if you will. Thanks for giving us a couple minutes here. It's exciting to talk to you.
Yeah, I'm so sorry. Things have just been a little bit crazy.
Oh, how dare you put off the world now known Verbal Shenanigans podcast for other stuff. I mean, but no, seriously, I was just saying before we got on that it would spark me to get in touch with you. I saw the preview for the movie, and I found it fascinating. And then I kind of went down a wormhole and started reading about your life and kind of the things you accomplished and kind of what where you are now with almost kind of reinventing the journey again. And I found it really fascinating. So I guess where we can start is I guess we'll start in the present and kind of go back. Well, first off, how did the movie idea come about?
So I did a talk at a primary school just down the road from me in London. And a guy came up to me afterwards and he said, my name's Alex Holmes, I'm a film director. And, you know, I just, please tell me that no one has made a film of this. So I said, well, no one has made a film of this. So he started talking about scripts and actresses. And I looked a bit disappointed. And he said, oh, you look disappointed. And I said, well, I just thought you'd use the footage. And he nearly fell over. He sort of went, oh my God, you have footage. So I said to him, I don't know how old you think I am, but we did actually have cameras in those days. And he was overjoyed because he's a documentary maker and that's it, that's his first love. So his next question was, where's all the footage? And I had to tell him I have absolutely no idea. And it actually took them 2 years to find all that footage. And it just, what an extraordinary job they did.
So what was the footage shot on during that time? Were you guys, like, were some of the crew just running cameras all the time? Or who was shooting footage?
Yeah, so the Whitbread Race Committee asked for volunteers to take cameras on the boat. And most of the guys were like, no, we're far too serious, roughly tufty ocean racing sailors. We don't have time to film. So we said, we will, absolutely. So they gave us a camera, and we all looked at each other and went, right, who's going to film? And we looked at Joe, and we said, well, Joe, you're not doing a watch. Why don't you go and learn how to be a camera woman? So she did, and she came back with a camera that was almost twice her size.
That's what I was thinking. On a boat too, it's not easy.
And you know, we built our own waterproof covering for it, and something to protect it from the freezing conditions. And we, you know, we really did put a lot of effort in, and we went practicing beforehand. And the first time we ever had a sort of an all hands on deck, Joe came up with the camera, and we all just went, well, you can put that down, you know, you're a sailor first. And that made us realize that we needed a second camera, we needed to fix it. So we fixed it to the radar mast. And we were actually the only boat that had two cameras. So Joe could film, you know, sort of moving around. And a lot of those shots I've never seen before. I have no idea how she got them. And then the really nasty stuff, the really great action stuff, we would get by turning the last person on deck would literally hit a panic button, and that would start the camera rolling.
Now, out of curiosity, when did any of you have to hold back just knowing there was going to be video footage of what you were doing and all? Were you about to, like, say something to somebody, you no good son of a sailor, I love you, get over here?
Well, luckily, girls are quite civilized on boats. We tend not to shout at each other. We tend not to be too nasty to each other, which is a different experience from sailing around the world with 17 men, I can tell you, which is what I did 4 years previously. So, no, I don't think any of us did. And I think Joe, after being told to sod off a couple of times, I think that she you know, got these little ways of you know, I mean, at one point, I think I look at a shot and I think, what were you sitting in a cupboard or something to take that shot? So she was very unobtrusive in the end. And we, in all honesty, we forgot she was there. And what you see is what we were.
Now, this movie comes out and it's put together. Was there Was it just as amazing for you to see this footage since you hadn't seen it in so years? Were you kind of blown away that there was enough to even make a movie out of this?
I have to say, we were quite surprised that Alex found over 100 hours of footage. And that's just what he found. But I guess, you know, if you think in those days, it wasn't like, oh, this is ours, you know, we're going to make a documentary or anything. It was just, we were just filming and we would get into each port and we'd hand it over literally to the news stations and they'd use it and hack it up and throw some of it away. And I mean, I think about that now and I just think, oh my God. But so, yeah, when we saw the film, I think... So we went through a bit of a bravado, I think, at the beginning, which was, right, let's tell it warts and all, you know, let's really go for this. And I think just before we all saw it for the first time at BAFTA in June last year, we were all looking at each other going, well, what have we done? we all watched it and we couldn't believe how accurately Alex had told the story. I mean, it was quite extraordinary. And then in turn, what he told us was that, yeah, you know, he'd found the footage. We didn't see the footage before he interviewed all of us. Huh. So what he was telling was the story through our words. And he said we all have very similar recollections, which is really interesting.
It's pretty cool.
Out of curiosity, like, how many events did they record? Was it just one race itself, or was it over multiple events that they got these recordings?
I guess there's a little bit of footage that was taken by news crews before the Whitbread. So during the refit of the boat and raising funds and everything else, I don't recall us recording. So I think that must be news footage. And then I guess it's a little bit from the Fastnet, and then the rest of it is it's all from the Whitbread.
Huh. Now, you know, we're talking in the present now about your story, you know, and reading up on you, you claim that you kind of, sailing kind of just found you, you kind of fell into sailing and got involved in this. How did this all actually come about, your interest in sailing or learning even just how to navigate on a ship like this?
I went to an arts and drama school. I trained to be a dancer and an actress. of course, I ended up being a sailor very naturally.
It's a natural line. It's a natural progression.
I was not good in school. I was bullied at school. I didn't have a great home life during my teenage years. So travel for me was something my mother actively encouraged. I think she knew I needed to be somewhere else. And... you know, I was working in a bar in Greece. Guy came in one night and said, would you like to stewardess on my yacht? So I went, yeah, okay, you know, 17 years old, don't really know what to do. And off I went, and I really did just fall into it. Very lucky. I had no qualifications. Actually, I still have no qualifications, no exams or anything else. And within 4 days, I thought, this is what I'm going to do for the rest of my life, which is... I can't tell you how lucky that felt like for someone like me, who didn't really think they were very good at anything at that age. And then I had, you know, luck has played a big part in my life. I had a lot of really great skippers, great mentors who saw something in me and pushed me, you know, and would say, well, why don't you learn to cook? You know, so I'd be like, oh, you know, I don't think I'm very good at stuff, you know, and they'd be like, well, it's more money. I'd, oh, okay, I'll learn. And then I was doing my second transatlantic and the guy said to me, can you navigate? And I said, of course I can't navigate. You know, I was expelled before long division. So so he said, you know, you need to learn these things. Otherwise, you're just a spectator in your own life. He said, you're a bystander. And I think that's one of the best pieces of advice anyone has ever given me, apart from my mum. And within 2 days, he taught me to navigate. And I thought, oh, my God, I'm not as stupid as I thought I was. That's amazing. And navigation became my passion. It's the thing that I still love more than anything else. And that's really what drove me to put Maiden together. I mean, it didn't start out as an altruistic fight for women's rights or feminism. It started out as a way that I could get to be a navigator. I had to create my own project.
So was it completely, you know, like the culture back then, was it just completely, absolutely controlled by men? Were you laughed at when you had this idea of being, you know, in this race? And I know, you know, what eventually led to you filming and forming an all-female crew. Were you, what was the culture like there?
Oh, the sailing culture then was entirely male-dominated. I mean, there were very few women who stuck their head above the parapet. It was a real lesson for me. I had no idea, really, because when I was on charter boats, I was, you know, I never came across sexism or misogyny because I was always where I should be in the galley. Mm-hmm. So no one, you know, really had anything to complain about. And I knew that when I announced an all-female crew, there would be a certain level of ridicule and laughing and, you know, people telling us we couldn't do it. But I didn't expect the level of aggression that we got. I was quite surprised about that. You know, like random men would come up to me in the pub and literally jab their fingers at me and say, "You're all going to die."
Jeez.
Wow.
Okay. I think that's my business, not yours. I don't really understand how that affects you in any way. So it was a big shock to the system. But I do often wonder, you know, if that hadn't happened, would it have given me I wouldn't have had maybe the fire in my belly that I had to get it done and to keep fighting.
So when you got when you learned your way and you came with this idea of finding a crew, how did you go about that? Did you have some women in mind? Were they friends? Or did you kind of have to, like, I don't know, like it reminds me of a movie, like you had to go and kind of find all the different pieces to kind of make up the team. How did that come about?
Yeah, I mean, I knew there wouldn't be enough women in Britain to make up a British team. I mean, we're a British project, but I knew that we would have to, you know, sort of scour the four corners of the earth sort of thing. In the end, it turned out I didn't have to look at all because Maiden just became a magnet for pretty much any female sailor that, you know, wanted to race or do something serious or had been told they couldn't. And we had hundreds of women come to us. And in the end, it was a bit of a natural progression because the selection process was over 2 years. And I mean, I have to say that, yes, OK, we were looking for great female sailors and, you know, an engineer, electrician, sailmaker, doctor, cook, all of these other jobs. But in the end, it was the stamina of the women, you know, that stayed the course that ended up being on the boat because, you know, I ran out of money on quite a few occasions. We all had to go and get jobs and we came back to the project. You know, I know in an hour and a half film, there's not enough time to, you know, sort of show a lot of this part of it. But I mean, at one point when we chose a woman to join the boat, we'd say to them, right now, you have to go and get an evening job, help build the boat during the day and pay for your own food. And they'd be like, OK. And I think as well, you know, I think disadvantages we used as advantages because all these men's teams, they had loads of money, they had crew houses, they had, you know, brand new shiny boats and brand new shiny uniforms, and they were all brand new and shiny, and we weren't. And so they weren't building that same team spirit as we were, which was, you know, it's us against the world. And, you know, by the time we got to the start line, we were battle hardened and ready to take anything on.
Amazing. So tell us a little bit about, like, yacht racing. As somebody who doesn't really know much about it, when most people hear yachts, they kind of think of, like, some millionaire in a like wearing a scarf, just drinking champagne on,
like,
on
you.
The deck of his
like you,
big
Mike.
Boat.
Like,
no, well, I mean, I was going to get to that, Scott, but well, I mean, kind of give us like some input on yacht racing in the sense that, is it like a bunch of different manufacturers? Is there teams? Are you going for distance or speed? What's the setup for yacht racing?
Okay, I mean, well, there are, you know, millionaires' yachts with millionaires sitting on them, but those boats are crewed by people like me, so which is great, because it gives us jobs. I think it's a shame maybe that yachting still does have an elitist image, and I know it does. I think probably mostly because the America's Cup, you know, which is the $60 million project, yeah. You know, which is unattainable for most of us normal people. But then, you know, there's the Olympics, which is you don't have to have money. You know, you go to your local yacht club, they will find you sponsorship. You learn to, you know, to sail and you know, the team, the country will get you there. Then there's lots of different types of ocean racing. There are some that cost an extraordinary amount of money. I think in the days when it was the Whitbread, it wasn't huge amounts of money. You know, I mean, the wages weren't huge then. I mean, we were just going from amateur to professional. The racing body, which always makes me laugh, was the Royal Naval Sailing Association. And, you know, they were all volunteers. And they put this amazing race together, and it was sponsored by Whitbread. And it was about stamina. You know, it was long distance. You know, you've got these long legs of 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 miles, which is, you know, 5, 6, 7 weeks at sea. Wow. And it's not a sprint. It's a marathon. And that's what makes this race such a level and equal playing field for men and women. You know, there are races that men and women can't compete against each other because they are heavier. They have immediate brute strength, which we don't have. But on a race like Whitbread, we're very evenly matched.
Right. Now, what are the living conditions like on a boat like that? Like the Maiden, for instance. What, give us like, so you had, how many was the crew again? The crew, how many?
12.
12. Okay, so give us an idea of how 12 people live on one boat. What is it like?
Compact and bijou, I think. saying that. So yeah, there's 12 of us. The boat is 58 feet long. She was very open plan. The only really enclosed spaces were the head, the galley, and the nav station. And then the rest is bunks. I mean, literally just bunks. And you have to have, the rules of the race say you have to have 12 bunks, one for each person. But when you're heeled over, which means when you see the boat tipping over, mm-hmm. You don't have anyone down the bottom side. You have everyone up the top side. Wow. Because you're trying to put the weight where you're trying to, you know, sort of pull the back boat as fast as possible. And that means that, you know, you, when someone comes down and needs to get into a bunk, you get up and you get and go and do your watch, and you get into a damp, smelly sleeping bag. You don't wash in some cases for 6-7 weeks. I know, ripe is the word for that. and you just add layers. I mean, in the Southern Ocean, why would you wash? It's minus 30 degrees below freezing. There's no heating on the boat. It's open to the elements. You just add layers and you go to the toilet really quickly, and you spend as little time as possible, you know, doing anything that doesn't involve being fully clothed. So it's not for everyone, but no. it's a complete level of living. It's a freedom from the way we live now, you know, and it's a real way of knowing who you are. You can't hide who you are. You are, you know, you're naked in front of your peers, really. You are who you are, and you can't pretend to be something you're not. It's, you know, it really is down to bare essentials, and that's an extraordinary experience. And knowing it's you and the elements is it's just amazing.
It's awesome.
Wow. I mean, with this kind of bracing, is it something where you can like actually like share info? For what I see, like the Maine's had a couple other captains that's raced it. Is it simple as like talking to another person saying, how would you handle this or that? Or is it just every race is a totally different project?
Yeah, I mean, you'd have different rules for different races. On the Whitbread, you're not allowed outside assistance. So all the information, well, you're allowed to get weather faxes in. I mean, those are the days of weather faxes. I mean, now, of course, everything comes on a laptop computer and, you know, it's all electronic technology. Mm-hmm. In those days, it was very much, you know, very basic technology. So it was really what you could get from it had to be publicly available for anyone to be able to get. So you couldn't call up and sort of ask someone for advice. The only thing you could ever call someone up about was if you had a life-threatening problem on the boat where you need to fix something. You can call people, and there is a huge camaraderie amongst the 23 boats. You're all out there in the middle of nowhere. The closest thing to you, any living human being, is another boat. So, you know, we would make sure we had each other's positions, that we knew we were all okay. And, you know, the problem we had with the problem Crichton's naturally had when they lost two crew members and one of them died was that our doctor spent 2 days on the radio saving the life of the guy who they pulled back in alive. So it's a strange world that you inhabit for that time you're at sea.
So now I also read that not too many years ago you were able to kind of get back in touch with the mate in the boat, and it was not in the best of shape. What ended up happening with the maiden?
Oh, yeah, I had to sell her at the end of the race. We never had any blooming money, so, you know, had to pay the crew, and so right. We sold the boat. And she kind of went from person to person, and I heard about her over the years, and sort of 25 years, I went on to do all-female crews and other racing teams, and I did know that she was getting a bit sad and tired, and... like the rest of us, really. she's grey as well as me. And so about 5 years ago, in fact, the week, almost to the week that I met Alex and he wanted to make the film about Maiden, I had an email from a mariner in the Seychelles saying, did you know that your yacht is, you know, has been sitting here rotting for the past 2 years? And if no one comes and gets her, we're going to take her out and sink her. Which was just shocking. So I called all the other original crew, and I went, right, we've got to do a big crowdfunder, which we all did together. We raised 75,000 euros in 2 months, which is, I just think, extraordinary.
Yeah.
And we bought her. We bought her in October 2016. I didn't know then what I was going to do or how I was going to afford to get her back or do the restoration or anything like that. And then I had a phone call from Her Royal Highness Princess Haya, who's King Hussein's daughter, and King Hussein funded us the first time around. And she called up and said, you know, do you need a hand? And she very generously funded the restoration of Maiden. And she looks now absolutely gorgeous, best she's ever looked. She's actually in LA at the moment, which is why I'm in LA with her. we're doing a 2-year world tour raising funds and awareness for girls' education. 130 million girls around the world currently don't have an education, and we'd like to be part of changing that.
How great is that? That's awesome.
Great project. We love it.
So I know you have a daughter also. What now? Have you been able to expose her to the world of sailing? Is she into what you've done, or is she like, I can't believe my mother did this? Like, it just like, is there any connection to it with her too?
For the last 19 years, she has resisted every attempt to get her on a boat or anywhere near a boat. I mean, poor soul, you know, the first thing anyone ever says to her is, oh, you're going to do what mummy did. She's like, no, I want to be a photographer. I'm an artist, thank you very much. But she did last year start working for me on the shore crew. She works as a photographer. She helps with our social media, and she's also at the moment running our shore events. But she had the crew, which is another all-female crew, younger, obviously, a bit fitter than we are now. they persuaded her to go on two legs of the world tour. So, you know, maybe quietly we've managed to get her sailing.
Nice.
For what I see, you're also now, you did project management for child exploitation and online protection. I mean, as you've been doing all this work, I mean, managing a crew, doing work helping children, I mean, do you ever sit back, I mean, from your days where you were, you know, sent out of school and just ponder how life came this way?
Yeah, I think the film has made me look at my life, you know, differently. I think I've probably, you know, we're our own worst enemy sometimes. You know, we don't believe we can do things that men go, yeah, of course I can do that. I'll just make it up as I go along. And you know, we don't tend to do that. I have imposter syndrome. Every time I achieve something, I feel embarrassed. I don't take pride in it. It's taken this film for me to look at what we've done over the past 30, 40 years and go, actually, I'm really proud. I'm really proud of what we've achieved. And I think, you know, now that we do a lot of talks in schools and we, you know, hopefully Maiden inspires hundreds of thousands of schoolgirls as we sail around the world, one of the best questions I get is, it's very, I think, perceptive from young people. They say, do you think you would have done everything you've done if you weren't expelled? And the actual honest answer to that is, I don't think I would have. Of course, the teachers don't like that answer, so I have to sort of temper it slightly. With, but don't do what I did, children. You know, stay in school and get an education and get your exams. It's an interesting point, and I think having had quite a few battles in my life, I think that's helped as well.
Yeah, yeah, battle hardened. Like you even said it earlier in the interview that you wouldn't have, maybe you wouldn't have had that even mentality to take on the concept of the men, you know, kind of holding you down almost to prove something. So it kind of comes full circle. Tracy, I think your story is absolutely fascinating, and I hope the movie does as well as it should. You know, it should do, because it's such a really unique story, and it's so amazing to think that you had no idea that this footage would even one day kind of resurface and become a movie. It's almost like it was, I don't know if you can call it destiny in a way, but it surely is really cool. And I hope people get to hear this interview and just the other interviews you've done and get to see the movie.
Thank you.
Really powerful story. And where is the best place for people to I guess either like dip their toe into the movie or go watch the movie or even see your journey? Where is the best place for people to visit?
Okay, so if you put Maiden Film into Google, it will come up with Sony and Dogworth websites where, you know, they can say where you can get the film. And if you go to our website, which is themaidenfactor.org, you can find out what we're doing. You can see the route we're doing and all the things that we're doing on land, meet the crew, and, you can follow the boat as she sails around.
Awesome.
Awesome.
Tracy, thanks so much for giving us a couple minutes of your time. We really appreciate it. It's just really cool to have you on the show.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Man, Mike, I think it's time for us to form our crew, you know.
Yeah.
Form our crew, start getting guys in place, and maybe put the Verbal Shenanigans ship in the water. What do you think?
I think so. I think I got some duct tape and a couple of old rusty canoes. I think I can get them all together. We'll get Sicoli, KP Burke.
I was thinking,
we'll all just dive in there and we'll go to the Atlantic Ocean and see who lives.
Well, there's no doubt in our mind that you have lots of duct tape, but I was thinking more of maybe like your imaginary friends that you revealed to us one episode. We can get the platypus and all the I forget what were some of the crew members.
It was an octopus for the record.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, there was a penguin. Woodpecker was in there. Yeah, I still got to figure out. I know there was well more than I think there was like eight of them. I'm going to have deep dig deep into my mind and find all my crewmen for this adventure.
I'm picturing a great cartoon. That's all I'm picturing. Like, you know, you and me in cartoon version, and then all these imaginary characters sailing around the world, maybe racing against Tracy and her crew. You know, we're kind of like the bad guys.
Like the wax races back in the 70s, you know?
Like, we would be the bad guys, and they would be, like, the ship, and we're always trying to, like, disrupt their ship and sink it.
Yeah, you tell me to shoot off a cannon, and it shoots right up in the air, and it falls down, and all of a sudden a dog starts laughing at us.
Yeah, yeah, like, our ship always has to be, like, we're really close to winning the race, and then something always happens every episode where our ship starts to sink, or we lose. Yeah, it's a good idea. It's a good idea. Let's get that ship in the water. But
all right.
Fascinating story. Tracy Edwards, everybody. All right. Tracy Edwards, Mike.
That's good stuff, man. I mean, she taught us that we all don't have to be snobby people to be yachters.
Yeah, no snobby yachters.
I mean, I'll still be a snotty yachter, just to keep it real when I do it.
Right, because that's what you're all about, keeping
it. Yeah, I'll wear, like, the all-white suit with the captain's hat and a monocle, and I'll look down on the other teams as I pass them.
How is that any different than what you do now?
Well, I'll be doing it on a yacht versus my canoe.
In your car.
It's really weird, the looks I get from my neighbors when I do it, you know, because we don't have a lake around here, so, but...
The monocles on different eyes every day. Yeah. But if you were like, if you had to go on that, like a yacht thing or anything really for like 3 weeks where you were in like a enclosed setting where you're not really getting off, is there like an item that like you kind of wouldn't be without, or like a home comfort or something that you would need to get through like that kind of time?
I mean, nothing I can really think of. I mean, maybe a pillow, because I'm very specific about my pillows. I get backaches when I get the wrong one, so that's about the only thing I could fathom.
So how? What is your pillow technique? Do you have like a special laying technique that you kind of get yourself in?
Well, it's kind of like one of those pillows meant for like the couch. They're like a little harder. And they're more compact, so your neck doesn't compress down on there. So,
I was hoping you were going to tell me it was like one of those pillows for like pregnant women that wrap around their stomachs that they lay on their sides, because that would be pretty amusing.
I haven't tried one of those, so maybe when I do my yachting experiment, I'll bring one on there and I'll let you know how it goes.
I feel like as long as I was able to brush my teeth, I feel like that's got to be. I couldn't do like weeks without brushing my teeth. I can barely go. You know, if I don't brush them at night sometimes because I fall asleep, I'm not feeling good about it.
That's kind of a nasty feeling, kind of like waking up in the middle of the night. Uh-huh. You realize you like fell asleep, you didn't brush your teeth. And
And then you got to do that whole debate, like, do I get up or do I just tough this out to the morning? No good. Yeah, I don't know. I don't think
I do the mouthwash in that scenario.
Mouthwash. Yeah, I don't know if there's like one item I would need, but I don't think I could do it either. I don't like closed spaces that much. The older I'm getting, I think I'm getting more claustrophobic. Like even the MRI I had to go for the other day wasn't even all the way in, and I was already like, even all I had to do was stick my leg in, and as the thing was like moving towards the hole, I was like, I don't like this that much. Like I don't like crowds. I don't like tight spaces anymore. I don't like waiting in line. So I feel like with being with like 12 other women or 12 other men on a ship where it's kind of like being in a crowd and waiting online all the time. I don't know. I don't think I could do it.
Yeah. I'm not claustrophobic, but yeah, I get that kind of thing. Like I'm one of those, if I'm trying to get to something, somebody's there, I immediately just go and just get pissed off, if you will. I can't do lines. I mean, everybody crying about that Popeye's chicken. I see the local one, cars are wrapped around the place. I'm like, nope, not worth it. Can't do it.
I haven't even really been paying attention. What is it? Is this another chicken sandwich or the same one from a couple weeks ago?
It's the same one from a couple weeks ago. The synopsis is basically they brought it out. I think their plan was just to be like, this is like a tester, almost like the McRib, where it comes for a few months, then it goes away. And they were just super surprised how huge it got, where they ran out of their supplies way earlier than expected, where they had to basically turn around and be like, all right, now we have to actually come up with a plan where we're going to have the sandwich full time, because it got mega huge. And they didn't want to give money back to Chick-fil-A, since they're the ones known for the chicken sandwich.
Interesting. Interesting. Have you had this chicken sandwich?
I have not, because, again, there's some, I don't know if it's here particular in Georgia or what, but any Chick-fil-A or Popeyes, minimum 1 hour wait. And Jesus. Like I said, I cannot do it. Like when we were going down to Savannah and we were on the outskirts and we're trying to find something, like, oh, there's a Chick-fil-A coming up, we'll go there. And it was like a Wednesday mid-afternoon, and it was still like 12 cars in the drive up. Every parking spot had a car in it. I'm like, no,
definitely not. No.
Refuse.
There's no chance.
Yeah.
Nothing, no fast food, first off, is going to be that good for me. I don't even, like, if I go to a nice restaurant and say like an hour wait or 45 minute wait, I generally be like, let's go somewhere else. I don't know. Just, it's not worth it to me. Time is way more valuable than just standing there. I don't know.
Only time it worked for me once was, I think it was a UFC fight where we went to Buffalo Wild Wings, and we put our name in. They said it would be about an hour. And what it basically did was, I'm like, all right, let's get in the car. Let's go to the other Buffalo Wild Wings on the other side. Took us about 20 some odd minutes to get there. We saw that they were packed. So by the time I drove back, I just went, hey, did you say my name? And they're like, well, no, but something just did open up. So I'm like, all right, let's go.
So you just had to do a quick tour of the Buffalo Wild Wings.
Yeah. Some people do a pub crawl. I do a Buffalo Wild Wings ride, if you will.
Buffalo Wild Wings doesn't impress me that much. I don't know. I don't think the wings are that great. They're okay.
It seems to be my go-to when it's like, if it's like a special day, she's like, what do you want to do? I just, even as I try to comprehend, okay, what can I do? What can I do? I just generally just be like, Buffalo Wild Wings.
Yeah. I mean, it's a good place to watch a game or something like that. It's definitely good or MMA is fun. The World Cup was fun. But the food's like average to me, and I find it kind of expensive too for what it is. Wild Wings,
I mean, I'm a wing guy, so I mean, I just, not one I came across like a local joint where I'm like, all right, that this beats that, and I gotta explore a little more. But I enjoy it and all. Like, I think we went there for my birthday, and I also went there for week one of the football season,
when there was still hope.
Yeah. But I'm like, hey, this could be something.
This is the season.
Washington went up by 17. I'm like, here we are. Here we go.
Looking good.
Then they did a second half, and that didn't turn out as well as the first one. So.
And basically the whole season's been that, been that second half.
Well, pretty much. I mean, you guys kind of had the same thing. You had that awesome high from the two-game Daniel Jones winning streak, and then that kind of just went
awful. And if Tampa hits that that field goal, we'd be 1-9 right now. Terrible team, awful team.
That's true. That's true.
Terrible coach, terrible GM. Don't know.
At least Jones is looking good.
Yeah, he looks good. A little fumble happy, but you know, he's so young. I'm not worried about it. But yeah, he looks all right. It's just, they're just not good. It's not good. They're very frustrating. But I don't know. Enough about football. What do you got, Berlo?
Well, as I was kind of talking about a couple weeks back, my wife and I, we took a trip down to Savannah. She had a nurses convention, so I basically had a free room to kind of explore down there. But we had an interesting experience on the one day. Now, before I continue with the story, are you aware of the Bagel Boss?
Yes. Tried to get him on the show. Never got an answer.
Yeah. For those who don't know, there was this viral video of this. I don't know if he's a performer, because I know he's got a site and stuff like that, but the guy's a very small individual, and he has videos where he just basically makes a fuss in some kind of restaurant or whatever, and there's a famous one where he was going off in a bagel shop, and he got choked out, if I recall, at the end of the video, where he was just going ranting and whatever, and somebody choked him out. But we went to Tybee Beach in Georgia, which is, I guess, it's kind of like their shore, if you will, here okay. down in Georgia. It's known, it's got a lighthouse, they got a boardwalk, they have kind of like, I would say, like shore kind of restaurants, if you will. So we went there on a Thursday night, and it was getting a little late. And Izzy was getting hungry, but I noticed that the local lighthouse was still open. And I wanted to kind of do that because I wasn't sure the next time we would come down here. And I'm waiting for the register, and I'm on the side, and there's this guy. I'd say he's probably about 5'3", if I had to make a guesstimate. He was low fives, high fours, if anything. And he's just on the side. He wasn't, like, right up there or anything. So I'm trying to rush through to get in there. So I just kind of walked up to see if there was a line. And when the guy said, next person, I go in front of him. And this guy's like, "But I was next in line. What are you doing?" And I'm being nice. I'm sorry. I didn't know you were in line. But he just kept going, and I can't believe this. I'm here in line, and you just walked right past me. And I'm like, I'm sorry. I didn't know you were in the line. You were in front of the register. And the guy kept going on and on about it. They had two people there, so he could go right to the person. I can get checked out. But it was one of those he would not stop.
Okay.
Where it was getting to the point where it's like, at first I was sorry. Now I'm almost glad I insulted your intelligence in some way. It was a very awkward situation where I'm literally like, all right, I'm actually getting close to slapping this guy. And I'm not sure if it's a bit or it's just a lifetime history of being a 5'3" grown man.
So you thought this was like someone doing bagel balls, trying to kind of capitalize. You're looking for people with their cell phones out, or
I was like, is this a new thing? Is this Lighthouse Lenny coming in here? And
did he?
Hey, I'm trying to get to the lighthouse. What the hell?
Did he seem under the influence of anything?
He didn't seem under the influence. Like I said, his big thing was not letting go, where I'm like, okay, is this frustration or almost character frustration?
So what was the end result?
I mean, nothing really escalated past that, because pretty much, like I said, I was in a hurry anyway, so I got my tickets, we viewed the lighthouse, and we went out to dinner. But it was just a weird moment where it was just like, we're on top of this lighthouse looking at this view. In the back of my head, I'm still like, God damn, I wanted to punch that little
Oh, you should have punched him. You could have been on, like, World Star.
I could have.
We could have got some hits, man. You weren't thinking about the show.
Yeah, that was true. I didn't have the shirt on or anything like that.
You could have just, like, beat the hell out of him and just kept saying verbal shenanigans over and over again.
You got shenanigans!
And again, and again, and again! Yeah. Think about the cover. If that goes viral, they'll be like, what the hell is verbal shenanigans? They'll Google it, and that video, and then all our podcasts would have popped up.
Yeah.
You know,
maybe I should have been performing that battle rapper that we had on here where he did a little verbal shenanigans rap.
Right.
I should have been singing that as I was punching this little guy in the face.
Yeah, and maybe like that would take off, and you know, like, instead of people yelling World Star when they beat people when there's a fight, they would now be like, verbal shenanigans, verbal shenanigans, oh snap, oh, they're fighting, verbal shenanigans, verbal shenanigans. See, you're never thinking forward, you know? You're always thinking about yourself. I'm kind of tired of it.
Well, after we record, I'll go outside and punch somebody in the face and yell verbal snake and see if we get anything.
Make sure you have the t-shirt on. What if we do like a... Like, I still have a bunch of extra t-shirts. What if we punch... You punch someone in the face, and then before they get mad, you give them a free t-shirt.
Yeah, well, if I knock them unconscious, I just lay it on top of their face, you know? So when they wake up, they're like, oh, now I get it! Oh, I can't believe I got on the show!
See, this, now you're thinking.
It's so worth a concussion.
Now you're thinking. You knock them out, and then you slowly drape the shirt over their head. And then, you know, like they wake up, they go, what the hell is this? And then by the time they wake up, the video is already uploaded.
Yeah. You're like, Berlew, the numbers at Tybee Beach, Georgia are through the roof thanks to you.
I mean, maybe
I never thought this was coming.
Maybe if you wear like one of those green man suits or like one of those skin suits and then had the shirt on, no one would know it's you and you can go around doing this for a long time before being arrested.
Yeah, I was figuring wear the green man outfit and literally have the verbal shenanigans shamrock on my face. Kind of like Starman from that old Nintendo wrestling game.
That's fantastic.
Game.
Yeah. Why? So exactly. Now you're thinking. So get on out there. And guys, expect these videos coming to you all week long from Georgia on our YouTube channel. So just don't tell it's Mike.
No. That would ruin the event. You know, I'm going to small parts of Georgia. Like, I'm not going to the prime areas. Like, Atlanta, I know there's other shows that punch people in the face in Atlanta. I'm going to, like, Rome, Georgia. And where the second Grand Canyon is in Georgia.
The second Grand Canyon, huh?
Yeah, I told you about it. The southern Grand Canyon. Then again, the other Grand Canyon's in the south. I forget what they call it. But
do they do the Confederate light show there?
And just punch them into the hole.
I like it. I don't know. You did you share a room growing up with your brother or anything?
With my brother, yep. Yeah.
I don't know why it just came up to me. The other day we were like, you know, we were like kind of sorting things out in our house or whatever. And like kind of where I'm sitting right now, there's boxes and stuff still that we still got to find places for. And I'm like, you know, like how do we have this much, you know, how do we have this much crap? There's two of us. You know, I'm like, I grew up, I shared a room with my brother basically until he was like in high school at least. Like at least I know I shared a room probably all the way up to like ninth grade, at least ninth or 10th grade. I feel like, and I'm like, you know, like it was basically the size of the room I'm in. I'm like, God, how did I, you know, I have this whole house and I have all this stuff that I don't need. Like a lot of it is like, what did I save this for? What did I save this for? I don't need this. And back then I had a room and it was perfectly fine. You know, like, I don't know. Did you have bunk beds?
Yep. My brother had the top bunk. I had the bottom bunk.
Me too. Your brother's older, right? Yep.
Yep.
I was always very, very jealous of the top bunk. I really wanted the top bunk. I remember me and my brother when we were younger, we would like play these games like on the top bunk and bottom bunk where there's a space between the wall. And he would like the whole goal was to try to like attack each other with like one hand coming over the side of the bunk. Like, so like he would like reach down and like try to grab me and like scratch me. And then I would try to pretend I'm asleep and wait till he's quiet and then jump up and kind of try to smother him and scratch him. And it would just go on and on and on and on for what seemed like hours. Back then it was probably actually like 4 minutes and then I probably fell asleep. But I don't know, man, sharing a room is like, I guess as a kid, it doesn't really bother you, but like now, if they were like, if I had to share a room with you, like every night, that would be horrific.
I think that we could grow kind of the podcast, like saying, all right, until we get 100,000 listens on a certain episode, Mike and Scott are going to bunk bed share for a year.
See, the viral, the things are coming. We beat people in the face. We share a room for a year. The problem was with that, like nobody would care, and we'd end up sharing a room for a year and get like...
Yeah, they would purposely not listen just because they love the fact that we'd be forced to live. But we make it fun, you know? You wake up in the middle of the night, I'm in the green suit. I'm like, shenanigans, and just punch you in the face.
And I just remember like... I don't know. I just felt like everything was like my brother's way for a long time. Like whatever music was on in the room was his music. If we played Nintendo when we had it, we didn't even have the TV in the room for a long time, but we had a TV downstairs. It was always whatever game he played, and I always had to pick the second team or the second character. Mm-hmm. I've said this before, but we played Tecmo Super Bowl a ton, and he was always the Giants, so I had to always pick a second team. So I kind of liked the Steelers growing up a little bit too. In Mario things, I would always have to get like Luigi or Toad or one of those. Yeah. So, but I remember just kind of always like it was older brother rules kind of thing. I don't know if kids share rooms as much anymore. I'm not sure.
I mean, I guess some people do because a lot of families are just trying to have cost savings or whatever. So,
yeah.
I mean, I still feel like as they're younger and all, usually for what I hear, it's like, when they're still like very young, share the room. When they get to like a 7 or 8, all right, now we got to get to a bigger house so everybody gets a room kind of deal. So,
I mean, how long did you share your room when you were a kid?
Let's see. We moved to Jersey when I was about 5 or 6, and I probably shared a room until, let's see, when did Hanky move out? He was probably 21, so that would mean I was 13, 14 when he moved out. I mean, I don't know how we survived as a family. Our first house in Jersey, or at least my first house, I mean, my parents lived in Jersey and they moved to PA and then they came back, but me and my brother shared a room. My sister and my grandmother shared a room.
Wow.
I obviously, the parents shared a room. One bathroom in the whole place.
Yep. We had one bathroom also for a long time. One bathroom, and then I told you about the toilet in the middle of nowhere, right?
you might as well retell it.
Yeah. So we had one. My dad's a real handy guy. Does everything on his own. I don't think he ever had anybody else pretty much do anything on that house. But we were... You know, our house was a 3-bedroom house. So when my sister was born, she got her own room. Me and my brother shared. Eventually, my brother moved in the basement for a little bit and kind of took up the whole basement, but it wasn't a bedroom. But my dad, so basically my basement was split into like a finished side and then like a, you know, washroom kind of side, you know, like basement side.
Mm-hmm.
And my father, so by the wash machine and then kind of off the side, put a toilet down there, like a working toilet, with the intention on building a bathroom around. He's like, oh, we'll put another toilet in here so we have somewhere else to go, and then we'll build a bathroom. Now, for whatever reason, time goes on and things get sidetracked, that toilet just kind of set in the middle of the basement. So it was like if you were to sit and go to the bathroom, like say you had to poop, you were kind of like the nearest wall to you was probably 10 feet on either side. Like you were in the middle, kind of in the middle of the washroom, you know, like
basically if they built a handicap stall in a house, that's where your toilet resided.
Correct. So years go by. Okay. And it started becoming like a joke, like, oh, the toilet in the middle of nowhere. So high school comes, I'd say. This is probably my junior year. Me and my best friend Alex were working out down there. Like I had set up my my weight bench down there and some weights and curling bars and whatever. So we were really into like kind of working out there and just kind of getting into it. And my buddy Alex is curling, and we had the weights back then with the collars on the end, like the red collars that you tighten the end so the weight wouldn't fall off. And they were never gray. It was probably $100 set of weights or something. And he's curling, and all of a sudden the red collar falls off the one end. And as he was struggling to get up, the weight falls off and blasts through the toilet. Like, so I'm talking like through the top of the tank, like the tank part, the fill part, and then into the seat. Like, so like through the whole toilet, like split in half, TV style, like you couldn't have split this thing better. So we go, oh no, you know, like, oh my God. So water's shooting everywhere, and I'm like, oh my god, my dad's gonna kill me. And so there's pieces of what's a toilet, porcelain, you know, everywhere. Mm-hmm. And porcelain breaks, it's sharp as hell, you know, like, so I go to pick up a piece of it, as I clean it, I slice my hand. So now I'm bleeding all over the place. My friend Alex is like, oh my god, your dad's gonna kill me. And we're trying to clean it all up, and I'm like, I don't know how to, you know, I didn't know how to shut the water off or anything like that. So I'm like, oh my god.
So the whole basement is filled with toilet water in your blood right now, is what you're telling me.
Yeah. So I had pieces of toilet everywhere. I mean, not every day you think of a weight going through a toilet. So I'm like, I got to go wake my father up. And, you know, this was relatively late. Like, we'd come over, we'd kind of work out at like 9 o'clock at night. It was kind of fun to do. And my dad always was a, you know, get on the couch with TV on for freaking 10 minutes, out on the couch, you know, after work. Like, he can never stay up. He's still like that. He watches something on TV, he's out like a light. So I could wake my dad up, like, you know, poke him, and he's face first, hair everywhere. I'm like, Dad? He's like, huh? I'm like, Dad? You know, and he's like, I'm like, we dropped the weight through the toilet. Huh? You know, like, wait. I remember this clear day. He's like, wait, what? Huh? Like, I'm like, he dropped the weight. He's like, wait, hold on. Like, give me a second. He's like, oh, wait? Through the toilet, and eventually gets up, and like, he does like this parent role, you know, like tired as hell, and comes down. He's like, what the hell? You know, has to shut the water off, and we got to clean this mess up. I'm bleeding. I'm holding like a towel on my arm. I mean, eventually, you know, by the end of it, we're laughing and cracking up. But my buddy Alex is like, oh my god, he's going to kill me. And like, to this day, we call my friend, we'll always bring it up and be like, oh, the toilet murderer is here, you know, like, he's like, be careful. And it's kind of lived on in folklore, but it was a pretty, the current state of the toilet, there is a toilet there, and he did eventually build a bathroom around it. Now it doesn't look, you were in my basement, so the toilet that was in my parents' basement is functional, and the toilet is no longer in the middle of a giant room. So
I was just hoping it would just stay there, and your parents tried to sell the house one day. How many bathrooms do you have? Well, one and a quarter, I want to say.
But where do you see the size of the second one? The master bathroom.
It's great. You could get a pump doing your curls and just dropping a deuce at the same time. It's wonderful. You got to try it out.
Yeah, maybe we should have like left the weights by there, like, and kind of made like a gym / toilet.
Yeah, this is great for squat. Now you squat on the bowl, and then you pump up your curls, and that, oh, you got to feel that burn. You got to feel that burn.
You ever do a piss in a deadlift? It's amazing.
Yeah. It just releases your body, you know, so you can just get more burn in your system.
The old bench press and puke, it's fantastic. It's fantastic. But yeah, so that's the story of the toilet. What was your dynamic sharing the room good? Like, did you guys get along, or did you all were at each other's throats?
I mean, growing up, my brother, I mean, I don't want to say we had a bad relationship, but I don't want to say we had a good relationship. It was one of those, we were 7-8 years apart in age, so it was always like, it was always his brother. Goal. It's like, when he was going to move out, he's going to move out, and I was just one of those. I do know, like, a funny story in our family. It was like, sometime when my brother went out with my mom and my sister somewhere. And I guess he had a bad day. Even as my dad tells the story, it's one of those, it's like, he had a bad day, and he was going back and forth with my mom, and I think he said like a curse word or whatever, but he was like, you know, with any kind of family, you can get into a fight, but there's certain like lines you don't cross, and he must have said something or whatever.
Yep.
And I think my dad was on the night shift at the time, and Like, he came home for lunch at that time because we only lived like 3 minutes away from where he worked. And my mom was still pretty upset from what happened. He's like, well, what happened? She described a story. And my dad basically went into our room, grabbed my brother from the top bunk, and just flung him from the top. And you get in, not catching you, apologize to your mother. I'm half asleep. I just remember a big old thump when it happened.
I remember one of the only times I ever saw my dad like mad was my brother was like, I don't know, they gave him money or something like that, and he was supposed to give him back change or something, and he was hiding the money and lying about it. And my dad came in, and I just remember him like the ultimate warrior, like, where is the money? And I'm in the bottom bunk, and he's in the top bunk, and he's like crying, no, Dad, I didn't have it. I'm like, oh, my God, I got that. And I remember him taking the top draw, and they couldn't find the money, and just being like, of the dresser, and just being like, gosh, gosh, like slamming it like the ultimate warrior, like the dresser. I'm like, oh my God, he's gonna kill Tim. But yeah,
see, kids, this is the great stories that you'll never live because you have timeouts now.
Yeah, you got
this. Is why we're so even. We could see these things and be like, all right, we can move on with life. We still love each other.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
Not abused.
Yeah, he only abused the dresser. I mean, I only got whooped a couple times. I got wooden spoon a few times. I got soap in my mouth. I got my share of things. But, you know, I turned out okay. I turned out somehow.
I think I have 3 career spankings from my dad. So, you know, I came out all right.
One for your 40th birthday. What's that? One for your 40th birthday. One for your...
Yeah. We can all laugh about it now. As I look back, I remember the 3, and I'm just like, yeah, I deserved them.
Exactly.
There's nothing I sit back and go, oh, you went too far. It was like, yeah. Exactly. Yeah, I probably would have done the same thing to me.
For sure. But, all right, Mike. I think it's time to wrap this gym jam up here and move on to the next one. Been fun tonight. Pretty cool.
And who knows where I'll show up in Georgia to punch somebody in the face. Tune in next week and find out.
Look for that viral video. We could also like give out t-shirts, and if you wear them in public, people are allowed to punch you in the face. So it becomes like it spreads, you know.
Instead of whip them out Wednesday, it's like slap your face Tuesday or something like that.
Berlo, anything to promote before we get the hell out of here?
Since we're recording on Veterans Day, I'll give a shout out to all our veterans out there. Thank you for everything you've done. A shout out to Ten Finger Frank, who was a part of the Navy, even though when he was dating, he tried to convince women he was in the Army, and his kids called him out on that, and he would tell them to shut up. But that's another story.
Yeah, you guys got to go back and listen to figure out what Ten Finger Frank is all about.
Yeah, well, 4th of July will be coming around. I'm sure I will retell that story. And I'll promote a little brewery that I highly enjoyed when I was down there in Savannah, Two Tides Brewing Company. It's this nice little kind of like two-decker house where the brewery is at the bottom, and then you can taste some of their fine beers by going upstairs or on the corner of DeSoto Street and 41st Street West. Some incredible IPAs, some sours. They have free pinball there. They have a nice view of downtown Savannah. Really nice place to check out. I highly recommend it. Some great beers there. So check out Two Tides Brewing Company.
Two Tides. And I'm going to quickly promote, I guess, the latest place you could find us on the internet if you're into internet radio. We're on a couple. But I'll point out the latest one, and that is Denville Radio, where I happen to live. He's been nice enough to kind of put us on the site and put our cast up there. Just a cool play. The guy's really trying to get his own little station off the ground here, so happy to provide our content there and hopefully get some new listeners. So go check them out. And then I got to promote our good old Tap House Comedy, Tap House 15 Comedy Show is coming up. It's a quick turnaround on this one because of the Thanksgiving holiday. So it's already going to be next week, November 21st. We have a fantastic lineup as always. So we also expanded the room. It is It is bigger and it's beautiful and is always a good time. It is free to go, so call and make reservations. There are some seats left, so that is the 21st. Come on out to Tap House 15. Great beer, great food, great comedy. Yeah. All right, guys. That's it, man. And I want to thank Tracy Edwards and her incredible story. Go check out her movie. It will not let you down. And that's about it. Please check us out. Leave us a review on iTunes or any of those. Please share the podcast if you enjoyed what you heard today. And that's it. And, of course, listen. Send us some feedback. We love that. That's it. Life is funny. Laugh at it and keep the wind at your back. Peace.
Later.